Hello, today is Monday, March 30th, and I open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We're going to start with the work sessions, since one of our members has to leave soon. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2414. Can we have a summary of the bill, please?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2414 allows Department of Human Services to add genetic siblings of adoptees to voluntary adoption search registry, defines rules for addition of and search for minor siblings on registry, allows sharing of certain types of information electronically. As you might recall, we heard this bill on 316. There is no fiscal impact noted and no revenue impact noted. Statements have both been issued. And that is that.
Are there any questions about this bill? All right. Let's have a motion.
You bet. Chair Kenny Geyer, I move HB 2414 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Peluso moves House Bill 2414 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please. Excused?
Rev. Evans?
Excused.
Rev. Gallegos?
Yes.
Rev. Hayden?
Yes.
Rev. Harris?
Excused.
Rev. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair
Felisa? Aye.
Chair Finnegar?
Aye. And we'll hold it open for Representative Evans on the first 2414, the registry for adoption for
I'm sure
siblings.
I'm an aye.
Oh, okay. That's good. All right. Motion passes. Close the work session on 2414. Open a work session on 2473. Robin, can we have a summary?
Certainly, Madam members of the committee. House Bill 2473 allows State Board of Licensed Social Workers to adopt rules on temporary licensure, including establishing fees. There is a -1 amendment pending that adds an emergency clause to this issue. There is no revenue impact, and it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, when did we hear it last?
We heard it on 3/23.
Okay, great. Randy Harnish, if you could please give us a quick summary of whatever you'd like to say about the bill, but particularly the amendment.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Peluso and Stark, members of the committee, my name is Randy Harnish, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers. This bill solved a simple problem, and that is we have a category of licensees who, as part of their application process, have to develop a plan of supervision. And a plan of supervision involves their employer. These licensees or these applicants are recent graduates and who are in the process of trying to find employment with which to develop a plan of supervision. And so we have kind of a catch-22. They can't get a job because they don't have a license. They can't get a license because they don't have a job. So this bill would allow the board to issue a temporary license as part of our general application process to kind of bridge that time between their submitting all the requirements for receiving an application, allowing them to find employment, develop that plan of supervision, and then get the full license. The -1 amendments add an emergency clause, which will allow us the ability to apply this bill, if it becomes law, to our current graduating class of social workers who will be finishing up school this summer and putting together their plans of supervision over the summer and into the fall. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair. Which specific license? Because your LCSW, you're talking about in the interim as you're working toward your LCSW, so which license would they actually be granted?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, this would, the problem that we're addressing at this point would apply to the CSWA, okay. the the kind of the intermediate step.
Right. And so you can't have a CSWA until you've got your plan in place and found your supervisor.
Correct.
And oftentimes your agency you go work for will oftentimes provide a clinical supervisor for you. And so this gets through that.
Correct.
It helps get them there quicker.
Yes.
Okay, but this is not their LCSW. They still go through their 3,000, 2,000, and all that.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. This doesn't change any of the requirements for the licensed clinical social worker. It just kind of bridges that gap to allow them to start collecting those hours.
For the CNSW. Great.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Does this apply at all to the BSW at all?
Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Gallegos, at this point, no, because that application does not require a plan of supervision. Only the clinical license requires the plan of supervision, which requires some connection to an employer.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, good. Representative Stark, would you like to give me a motion?
Yes, we have. Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/12/15.
Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/12/15 for House Bill 2473. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Stark.
Yes. Chair Kingeyer, I move House Bill 2473 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2473 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please. Excused?
Rep. Evans?
Aye.
Rep. Gallegos?
Aye.
Rep. Hayden?
Aye.
Rep. Parrish?
Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Felusa?
Aye.
Chair
Kingeyer? Aye. The motion passes. Let me see. Who would like to carry this? Would you like to do that, Representative Stark?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done this yet, have we?
Oh, we did. Okay. Go back. All right. Right now. All right. We're going to reopen the work session on 24/14 for the purpose of assigning a carrier. Who would like to carry that bill?
Which one is that?
2414 is the parents one. Of the guardians, the opening the registry
I'm
for adoption.
2694.
The sibling adoption.
The sibling adoption
registry.
Would anyone like to?
I can do that.
Would you like to do that? All right. Representative Peluso, thank you. Close the work session on 2414.
Thank you. We have others that came in that we want to suspend rules.
Rules
to vote rule on
to
that.
Vote.
Who missed that vote?
I think Parrish missed it.
Parrish, would you like to vote?
Anyone else?
Would anyone like to move to suspend the rules?
Chair Kingeyer, I move to suspend rules in order to allow Rep. Parrish to vote on House Bill 2414.
Any objection? Do I need to gavel before we open it? Yes.
Reopen it.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Parrish, you are a yes. All right. That was on 2414. That's a yes. Close the work session for a third time on 2414. We're really working that bill. Okay. That's still not here, right? Where it is. Can we go back to that one?
Can you go back to that one?
Okay. I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2219 for the purpose of rescinding a referral to Ways and Means. Okay. Representative Peluso.
Chair Kenegeyer, I move we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2219 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Peluso moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2219 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be and that the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. It's rescinded, though, right?
Right. I thought we were rescinding.
It comes later.
Oh,
Madam
okay.
Chair, it
oh,
comes
okay.
later.
Yeah. Is there any discussion? Those of the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2219 be moved as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference will vote aye as opposed to no. The clerk will call the roll. Excused.
Yes.
Chair Gallegos?
Aye.
Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Chair Parrish?
Aye.
Chair Taylor?
Aye.
Chair Stark?
Yes.
Chair Gallegos?
Aye.
Chair Hayden?
Aye. The motion passes. The vote will be reconsidered. Members, House Bill 2219 is still before the committee for a new motion. It turns out that we had minimal fiscal impact, and it no longer needs to go to Ways and Means. That is the purpose of the referral.
So, Chair Kenny Guyer, I move House Bill 2219 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Peluso moves House Bill 2219 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Okay. Clerk, please call the roll.
Clerk Ewing?
Excused?
Rep.
Yes.
Rep. Gallegos?
Aye.
Rep. Hayden?
Aye.
Rep. Parrish?
Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair
Peluso? Aye.
Chair
Kingar? Aye. Okay, the motion passes.
Thank
you. And I close the work session on 2219 and open a work session on House Bill 2694. Robin, summary of the bill.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2694, we heard the bill on March 20th. It permits the Department of Human Services social workers to report animal abuse or neglect in a work capacity. It defines abuse and neglect of animals, and it relieves liability on social workers acting in good faith. And it applies to reports of abuse before, on, or after the effective date. There is no revenue impact, and it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, I see that we have George Okulich here. If there are any questions, are there any questions about this bill? No, all right. I'll just keep going then. Representative Stark, could you please read the motion?
Chair Kenny Guyer, I move House Bill 2694 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2694 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Chair Buehler?
Excused?
Chair
Bevin? Yes.
Chair Gallegos?
Yes.
Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Chair
Parrish?
Aye.
Chair Hayden?
Aye. Vice
Chair
Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. Motion passes, and Representative Gallegos, can you please be the carrier?
Oof.
All right. Close the work session on 2694. Open a public hearing on 2706. Robin, can we please have a summary?
Okay.
We'll stand at ease.
Thank you.
Is she here?
Or the one she came in right after.
That is a good question.
You want me to find out?
Yes, that would be great. Bill, while Representative Nathanson comes forward.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3016 restores capital gains tax exemption for sales to entities that include tenants, nonprofits, and housing authorities, modifies time limit for tenants to form or associate with competing entities and submit purchase offer, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2015, or before January 1st, 2020, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, a representative from House District 13. Oregon has over 1,100 manufactured home parks in 57 of our 60 districts. These parks provide 63,000 residential spaces for affordable housing. Nearly every legislative session since 1997 has had a bill negotiated successfully by the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition. And this is another in that long history of collaboration. This bill represents over 30 hours of negotiations over the past year to reach a consensus. There are several aspects to this bill. It already passed through the House Revenue Committee for a housekeeping corrections to a capital gains exemption for landlords who sell their manufactured housing parks to their residents. It also has several technical fixes to the 2014 bill that set the rule for residents who come together to make an offer to purchase their park. The amendment hot off the press, so to speak, that you have before you now, I think it's around 50 pages, it adds in substantive changes that are the result of those negotiations, and they address the housing side of things. Revenue Committee handled just the revenue part. I'm going to give you just a very brief overview, and others who follow in testimony behind me can provide detail. There are four main parts to the amendment. You will hear the detail in a moment. The first preserves and increases the capacity of the Manufactured Communities Resource Center. The MCRC is a program of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. It is a critical resource for both tenants and landlords to promote cooperative relationships. The next part allows landlords to have back taxes canceled on abandoned or manufactured homes in certain situations. That will happen in some parks. The third part amends the habitability requirement for a manufactured home park to include providing natural gas or propane where it is available, and the maintenance of the surface or ground under the manufactured home. The fourth and a significant part of the amendment is a successfully negotiated set of regulations to address conflicts of interest when a tenant chooses to sell their home, and the relationship between the park owner or the owner's representative, the relationship between the park and the homeowner, in this case the homeowner is also a tenant, when that relationship is happens at the point of a sale, sometimes there is a perceived or a real conflict of interest with the prospective buyers or renters. Last fall, a constituent who you'll hear from later today contacted my office with concerns about certain sales practices that were being used by park management. I visited the park to learn what was happening. The bottom line is this. The homeowners, who are tenants in the park, they're renting the land, but they own their home. They decide it's necessary or desirable to sell their home. They're selling their home, but remember, they're a tenant in the park. If the park owner is also a homeowner, owns other homes in that park, we believe that the tenants and the park owner or the owner's representative should be competing equally in the marketplace for buyers. And the tenants should be confident that they have a fair chance. It's just about a level playing field between sellers at that point. I'm pleased with the hard work over the past months and that the coalition has once again come together to find solutions. Thank you for your time, and I hope you'll pass the bill.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, Kenemer State Representative District 39. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you, and many thanks to Representative Nathanson, too, for her good work. As far as I know, she covered most all of the details. You probably don't need me to do a second rendition on those, but we could and waste a lot of time. But secondly, I guess it does bring back some memories. As some of you know, I spent time in the Senate back in the previous century, and it was an interesting experience because we used to have the housing wars, as those of us in the business committee called them. And we would have the tenants come in 1 year, and then the next session we would have the owners. And it was a very difficult choice. Which of our children did we love the most or the least? And it was difficult to make those choices. And lots of times the reaction the next time was in response to what had come previously. So today I wanted to commend them across the years. With a few exceptions, they've done the very difficult job of working together. And I'd say a special commendation goes out because I remember my marriage counseling professor saying, we'll do a better job if we remember we're all incompatible. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not easy, and it's not an accident when people choose to sit down and work together to a common goal. And I think this is to be commended. This is an exceptional effort. Appreciate the good leadership from representative and from all who have participated, and would urge your passage of the bill.
Great. Thank you very much for working together on this. Are there any questions for them before we go to the next panel? Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. John Van Landingham, Chuck Carpenter, Susan Sparks. And Susan, if you want to wait for Donna, you're welcome to do that too, since you're both from Lane County. You want to wait?
We can bring
up four. Or you can all come together.
Let's have a party.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County, based in Eugene. I think I should go first because Chuck likes to piggyback on what I say. We've been doing this a long time, and I believe these two residents are going to say some things that you may have questions about, and I'd probably be the best person to try to answer those. Representative Nathanson already described the coalition, so I won't repeat that. I will note that then-Senator Kenner did create the coalition in 1997 when there was the ongoing wars between the residents. I was not involved at that yet, and Chuck was in the legislature in 1997. The tenants wanted a bill on abandoned property, and the landlords wanted it to be different, and they couldn't agree, and Senator Kenner told the two sides, I was in the room, told the two sides to go out in the hallway and not come back until they'd reached agreement. And here we are, what, 18 years later, wow. Tenuously sometimes, but still negotiating issues. I want to thank Senator Kenner, then-Senator Kenner, Representative Kenner, and Representative Nathanson, both of whom have been real leaders on manufactured housing issues. I am the primary tenant advocate within the coalition. Chuck is the primary landlord advocate within the coalition. It consists of tenant representatives, landlord representatives, manufactured housing manufacturers, and other interest groups, local governments, state agencies. Representative Nathanson already described what we do. This is the every session since 97 we've had a negotiated bill. There are several members of the coalition who are in the room and who are hoping to escape having to talk to you, but I want to out them. That includes Genoa Ingram, who represents the manufacturers of manufactured home, Rick Blackwell from Department of Consumer and Business Services, and then most importantly to us, two tax collectors, Diane Belt from Washington County and Tammy Little from Clackamas County. We could not have negotiated one of the huge issues that we've got in this bill without them. And in particular, I want to recognize Diane Belt because she's retiring after this session. And if we hadn't done this session, we probably couldn't have. I also want to note that one of the tenant advocates who caused that disagreement in 1997 was a couple of people. And some of you have been in this legislature before would recognize Pat Schwach, who is white-haired and very feisty. Her husband, Fred, who was also a leader with her, Fred died 10 days ago, so I wanted to recognize Fred. You've got my written testimony in OLIS. It describes in four pages what's in the bill. It describes what was in the printed bill and also what's in the amendments. The amendments are gut stuff. We just got them this morning about 10. I haven't read them. I don't know that they're right, so this isn't going to be a work session. We're not ready for a work session because we need to make sure they are right. I can talk about the details if you want, but I think probably it would be better for me to just see whether you want, if you have questions about the details. That's me. That's it.
Chair Kenny Geyer, committee. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm executive director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and we represent about 500 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. We represent the folks who own the community. We're very happy with this bill. As with any compromise, there are things in the legislation that we kind of wish weren't there. But overall, I'd have to say, after negotiating these bills since 1999, this is a bill that I'm particularly enthused about. I think we've struck a very good balance. The piece that addresses abandoned homes and the back taxes owed on those homes, I think, goes a long way towards preserving manufactured home communities and preserving affordable housing. And that has been an issue that we've been, the specific tax issue has been something we've been wanting to work on over the last probably 8 years. So we're very happy that we have been able to come up with a good compromise. I'd like to thank John for all the hard work that he does and all the patience, the infinite patience that he has when it comes to these issues. He's been a great person to work with. Diane Belt as well. Very much appreciate what she has been able to do for us as far as understanding this issue. And overall, I have to say that the association and our members are pleased with this proposed legislation.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donna McAdams, and I am a constituent of House District 13. Thank you for this opportunity to speak before you and tell you why I wholeheartedly support House Bill 3016. I live in a 55 and older park. Many of the tenants are quite old and are in poor health or not mentally up to speed. For many of us, our homes are our biggest monetary asset. When the time comes for us to sell, we want to get a fair price for them because that might be the bulk of the money that we'll have to live on for the rest of our lives. Last July, I had a buyer for my house that was better qualified for park approval than many of the tenants here. She had the cash to pay for my house, income, and excellent credit. When she was denied approval, she had a well-qualified co-signer, but this manager still refused to grant her park approval. Katie Berry tried to buy the house on space number 114, but the manager refused to grant her park approval based on her income. She's on Social Security, but had just come into an inheritance. She offered to write a check for the entire space year's space rent in advance, but he said no, and then offered to give her park approval to rent one of the park's houses. The seller told Ms. Berry that she was the second buyer that he had turned away. The house on space number 146 had been vacant and for sale for several months. Karen Kellums called this manager to show it to her, but he told her that it was very small, had a weird floor plan, and that she wouldn't like it. He told her to check out several houses that he had for sale. After viewing his houses, she was fed up and ready to leave if he didn't show her number 146. He finally let her in to see it, and she bought it. I also know two other buyers that he discouraged from buying that house. In 2010, Doris owned the house on space number 2. When she tried to sell it, this manager turned away three buyers, stating that there was a conflict of interest, but he never told anyone what the conflict was. Later, when another lady applied to buy number 2, he withheld park approval until she looked at all the houses that he had for sale. This manager gave Carol approval to buy the house on space 177, yet she had bad credit and no income. As she signed the lease agreement, she saw that some of the papers had the name of a park in Portland printed on them. She told the manager that this inaccuracy made her uncomfortable and asked him to correct it. When she went back to sign the corrected papers, he increased her space rent $50 per month higher than it was just a couple of days before. Thank you for allowing me this time to speak before you.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Sparks, and I am a constituent of House District 13. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
regarding proposed House Bill 3016. I am a real estate agent and am well acquainted with the high standards that are imposed upon an agent licensed with the state of Oregon in the matter of working with buyers and sellers and the ensuing conflicts of interest that can arise. I currently live in a manufactured home park. Based on my experience of over a decade of working in the real estate business, it is clear to me that the manager or owner of a manufactured park who is leasing or renting the land upon which residents own a home while actively buying and selling homes in the same park presents himself as a competitor for the buyers who might be interested in a home a resident has for sale. Further, he is solely empowered to approve or disapprove those buyers or renters. My personal experience is that upon finishing the approval process to lease a lot, the manager asked my husband how much he paid for the home. Upon hearing the price, the manager dramatically threw his head down into his hands resting on the desk and then made the declaration that he paid too much, which I knew was not a true statement based on my market analysis, and in fact the house was purchased at below market value. During a subsequent meeting, he told me that he could save me some money by selling me a brand new home, although it would have put me in debt $30,000. The problem with these statements is that he is working with senior citizens who might actually believe his statements to be true simply because he has been the park manager for a number of years and should have firsthand knowledge of market information. Senior citizens routinely have mounting physical and sometimes mental limitations and can be preyed upon by those that they believe to be experienced authorities and are often the victims of scams. It would have profited the manager to sell that new home. Because every buyer is required to meet with a manager for lot lease approval, it gives the manager private access to prospective buyers who might not have any representation and who receive no disclosure about who the manager is working for. It is not uncommon for the manager to steer the buyer to the homes he is handling the sale on and make declarative statements in favor of his interests. Many of our residents have told their heirs to just give the title of their home to the manager and walk away so that they are no longer saddled with lot rent and the inability to sell the home because time after time sales do not close unless the manager is handling the sale. But even then, if there is an opportunity, he may offer the resident a low price and without disclosing any of his interest, sell the home for a far higher price, all the while with knowledge of a prospective purchaser. That happened to Wilma Tunison. He told her he was having trouble selling her home that he had listed, so he offered her $1,500 for it and then sold it the same day for $10,000. As an Oregonian and manufactured home resident, I support House Bill 3016. Homes are often the biggest asset an estate has, and the impact on elderly residents is huge with no accountability in place. Requiring a selling manager to be licensed will allow residents an oversight of conduct that is grossly lacking in the current state of affairs. Thank you for your time.
These are very powerful stories.
Mm-hmm.
Are there questions? Thank you so much for bringing that. Thank you all for working so hard together. It's really such an admirable example for all of us in the legislature. Is there anyone that John mentioned who's here in the room? Raise your hand if there's anyone in the room. Thank you. Thank you so much for working on this. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3016 and open a public hearing on 2706 for Representative Frederick. And Robin, could you please read the summary?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3016. Oh, pardon me. House Bill, yep, I gotcha. I picked up the wrong paper. My apologies, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2706 restricts juvenile detention facilities and staff from using isolation as punitive or rehabilitation intervention except in prescribed circumstances, prescribed standards and time maximums for isolation, requires hearing board, including detained juvenile and staff, to consider continued need for isolation within the first 12 hours of isolation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Lou Frederick, State Representative from District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland. Has the OIA folks, are they already?
They're here, but they've not presented. You are the
not
first
presented.
One on the
okay,
bill.
Okay, well, thank you. I was just wondering. Their PowerPoint sitting up here, and I'm going, oh, okay, yep. That's interesting. Well, I'm going to tell you about this particular issue by way of a story. It's a failure of mine that I tend to go primarily with stories, but this works sometimes. I had several people come to me, one who had done a tour of one of the facilities and discovered that they were given a nice tour and they had a grand time. It was a public tour. And another person who went in to do a tour as a prospective employee. And that tour included one of the supervisors talking about and bragging, apparently, about isolation rooms. And that they were, in fact, keeping some people in isolation rooms for not just a couple of hours or a day, but for several days. And these were young people. And that person came back to me and said, I can't believe that they're doing this. And I said, you're right. I can't believe that they're doing it either. As it turns out, we have some legislation and so we have some regulations that limit the amount of time folks can be placed in isolation rooms. But the bragging that went on in that particular facility said that they would take somebody out for a couple of hours so that they would break that length of time and put them back in. It was clearly being used primarily as a punishment, not as a way of actually dealing with the issues that were involved in a facility. I was pretty upset, very upset, and early on filed this particular bill as a potential way of dealing with this issue. Then I went to a juvenile justice conference down in my district, right at the convention center, and heard that the OYA folks and others did in fact know about this and were trying to stop it. Because this is not just a punitive kind of situation. It affects the mental health, certainly of any young person who's placed in an isolation unit for days or hours even, but days certainly. I found out that they in fact were trying to find some way to deal with this. This was not something that was foreign to them. It was on their radar. The question is, how do they get it done? How do they get it across to their colleagues, to the folks who are working in the system? So we brought this bill forward, and I'd like for you to take a look at it. It is, I think, it is a bill, an attempt to try to deal with these issues, but I'm also pleased to say that I think we have a change in the culture that is underway right now within OYA and other systems to try to look at this as not the way to be effective in dealing with young people and in dealing with even problems in a facility. But it is something I think we need to make sure that we're looking at. And if we will be bringing some other amendments forward to deal with some problems we have encountered within the bill itself, and frankly, an amendment that asks for a regular reporting on how and when isolation units are being used. So that's what we brought forward. I think you've got the OYA and several other people who want to speak on this, but this is why we brought it forward. Thank you,
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick. I'm just curious, what's the time frame of the story that you gave? Is that very recent?
That was it would have been before September.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing this to our attention. And I'm going to call up Ferry Boers Pakshet. Are you a panel together?
Yes.
Okay, so Joe Ferguson, let me see. You'll have to introduce yourselves. I'm not sure if you're on the list here.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Guyer, members of the committee. For the record, Chair Boers Pakshet, Oregon Youth Authorities Director. With me today is Clint McClellan, who's the Assistant Director for Facility Services, and Aaron Foltz, who's the Chief of Operations for Facility Services. Both Aaron and Clint have extensive experience working directly with youth and also in administrative and leadership positions within Oregon Youth Authority. Let me quickly, before I start this presentation, say that House Bill 2706, as currently drafted, does not relate to OYA and will have no impact on us. In fact, the bill strictly addresses detention facilities. I don't think the folks that moved the bill forward had intended to do that. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. So for that very reason, I'm not going to be specifically addressing the bill. I'm going simply to talk about our practice and the use of isolation, and these are what we'd like to cover. We'd like to provide a definition for isolation as we define it in Oregon Youth Authority. I'd like to talk a bit about our concerns about the use of isolation, because believe it or not, we have a lot of concerns as well. Our current policy on isolation, the national conversations that we've been engaged in, and our role in moving those conversations forward, how our approach toward the use of isolation has shifted and changed over the course of the past 5 years, what has been the result of that change, what kind of policies and practices have changed, and what have been the outcomes of those changes. And then challenges and opportunities that we face in continuously learning and improving as we move down this path. We hope to do all of this in about 20 minutes and then hope to hear your questions and concerns. So let us begin. We go to the definition of isolation, and this is how OYA defines isolation: as any instance when an offender is confined alone in a locked room because of the offender's behavior or conduct. So what are our concerns with isolation? We know through research, through our own practice, that isolation can be psychologically harmful, especially for those who have pre-existing mental health situations. We know that isolation can increase suicidal tendencies. We know that isolation can interfere with education and treatment. And we also know that limiting human interaction can slow down that natural developmental cycle, specifically for adolescents. So our current policy on isolation is that it must be used only when an offender is a danger to himself, herself, or the safety of the facility. It must not be used for punishment, as a convenience or substitute for staff supervision, or as a substitute for individualized treatment. That actually youth have a due process. And what do I mean by due process? In fact, what that means is that a manager or officer of the day must authorize isolation placement. A youth must be offered an isolation hearing within the first 24 hours of being isolated. An isolated placement must only last until the offender regains control and is ready to reintegrate back into the living unit. What do we mean by safety? We mean that a staff must monitor every 15 minutes the youth and make sure that he or she is safe. What do we mean by needs? We mean basically basic living conditions in isolation must include simple things such as food, clothing, bedding, meal, reading materials, personal hygiene, and access to OYA complaint hotline. We have a 24-hour hotline that any youth has ready access to report complaints or abuses. That qualified mental health therapist must check in on the youth at least once a day. That a treatment person that's actually assigned to the youth must at least visit that youth once per day. And that basic services such as medical services, personal visits, recreation, religious services, education, and treatment must be provided while the youth is in isolation. This next slide actually lists the conference calls, seminars, webinars that we have attended in various capacities. The very last bullet, Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators Toolkit, I believe all of you have a hard copy. This was just published last week. And you can see that OYA has been engaged and actually one of the leaders in this process and have been cited twice for best practices on this topic. So before actually we go to the next slide and before I ask Aaron to talk about our use of isolation, I want to say that, you know, we don't want to be defensive about this issue. We would like to work with those stakeholders and advocates who have better ideas about how to manage this. We hope that through this presentation, we can share the challenges that we face with this topic and also the opportunities that exist. So with that, I'll turn it over to Erin.
Thank you. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Erin Foltz. I'm the Chief of Operations for Oregon Youth Authority Facility Services. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our recent milestones and outcomes around use of isolation. So like really all practices in human services and maybe in all services, our isolation policy and practice changes and evolves over time as we learn as research tells us about what is most effective in achieving our desired outcomes. And so in the not very recent past, isolation was seen as the best practice intervention for dealing with behavior management in a correctional facility, both adult and juvenile. We obviously have learned that it does affect adolescent development and does not help us achieve our desired outcome, which is a youth who is accountable for their behavior and their crimes in the community, but also has the opportunity while they're with us to develop skills that will help them, support them in being safe, productive, healthy citizens and neighbors once they leave. So in 2010, we made an amendment to our existing policy that Faribor's discussed that already limited the use of isolation to only situations when a youth is in imminent risk, to also putting a time limit of no more than 5 consecutive days in isolation. And during that time, that youth is receiving those services that Faribor's just described. And that also put us in line with the American Correctional Association's juvenile standards. In 2012, we closed a behavior management unit that served the state's most aggressive youth. And so youth that were placed in that unit at McLaren had to have demonstrated a pattern of assaultive behavior toward staff or youth to be placed in the program. And it relied heavily on short-term and frequent isolation as a behavior management tool. But we were not seeing the outcomes that we wanted, which in this case was reduced violent behavior. So as, again, we were becoming more aware of the research and national conversation regarding the impact of isolation, we decided that we wanted to close that unit and find a way to repurpose those resources to a more proactive approach to dealing with behavioral issues. And we were able to do that in the form of skill development coordinators, which were implemented in October of 2013. And those are a group of staff who have some additional training in collaborative problem solving, trauma-informed care, and positive human development. And they focus on that proactive problem solving with our most behaviorally challenging youth, finding healthier ways for them to manage emotions and hopefully avoid incidents that can lead to isolation. So as a result of some of those efforts, you can see our use of isolation trend over the last 4 years from 2010 to 2014. And that trend line is going the direction that we are wanting it to go. As our focus on a more proactive approach increases, our isolation has continued to decline. And if we drill down further into the last year's data on our use of isolation since the implementation of those skill development coordinators focusing on a proactive approach, you can see that the trend line has an even steeper decline. So reduction of the use of isolation is a top priority for the Facility Services Department, and we are continuing our discussion, have a number of new initiatives and actions that we hope will further impact that decline.
So when we talk about isolation, really what we're talking about as far as an effective long-term strategy, we're talking about a change in mindset and culture. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the conditions in a youth correctional facility. This environment that we sit in really uniquely sits between child welfare and adult corrections. We get nowadays a youth up to age, they're with us up to age 25. They're not really children any longer. Some of them can be quite assaultive, and the staff can be pretty afraid of their safety when they go into the facility and have to face this day in and day out. out. So when we talk about the reduction of some of the techniques that have been used in the past or some of the measures that have been used in the past, the very first thing that comes to the staff mind is the fear for their safety. And we all know that, at least in my case, my staff are a whole lot smarter than I am. And they can run circles around me as far as doing workaround, regardless what policy or directive be put in place. So the approach that we have taken in Oregon Youth Authority is what we call the positive human development. I talked about it briefly last time when I was in front of the committee in February. And this is a notion that actually emerged nationally, positive youth development. How do we deal with youth and consider them as assets rather than liabilities? And through our interaction, try to arrive at a positive rather than a deficit. We chose to actually title that positive human development because we believe that in these interactions, we are also learning. That every day in interactions with youth, we are also learning new skills and new ways of trying to address this issue of isolation. This next slide, that triangle, should not be unfamiliar to you. I shared this with you last time, but very briefly, when we talk about positive, we're not really talking about lack of accountability. We're not talking about happiness. What we're talking about is healthy, optimal, growth-focused, and a strength-based approach in order to deal with youth. When we talk about human, we're talking about anyone who comes in contact with the youth, and when we talk about development, we are talking about changes in our own behaviors and abilities over time. And specifically on that triangle, you can see that safety and security is at the foundation of this model. We are not giving up accountability. Accountability is at the heart of this triangle. And ultimately, it is meaningful participation and connection to community that makes the system work. We understand that isolation is not conducive to positive human development, and we are committed to reduce the use of isolation, again, in a way that is not directive top-down with a hammer, but really with the understanding of this concept that as we go down this path, we are actually creating a safer environment for staff.
So within the context of the positive human development kind of culture change that's happening across the agency, Facility Services is working on some specific initiatives and actions addressing isolation. The first is the implementation of the Isolation and Reintegration Oversight Committee, which started in October of 2014. And that committee's goals are to review and redefine when and how youth may be placed in isolation based on national best practices and research, to delineate how OIA will continue to ensure that due process rights are met, to develop effective community reintegration programs and processes after an incident to bridge the gap between the youth and the living unit community, to identify resources to support that community reintegration program and process so that it is implemented and sustained as designed, and to align our related OIA rules and policies to the committee's recommendations. And in terms of the reintegration program and process, I think it would be good, I need to mention that we are working in facilities that were built at a time when isolation was seen as the most appropriate intervention for managing behavior. And so this committee has its work cut out for it in trying to find resources and be creative in how we build a community reintegration program in those facilities. And one of the actions that came directly from the initial work of the Oversight Committee was the deployment of additional skill development coordinators that are currently unfunded to focus specifically on providing intervention and reintegration efforts after an incident requiring isolation. And that skill development coordinator works with both the youth who went to isolation as well as with the youth and staff on the living unit where the isolation occurred. And finally, the Isolation and Reintegration Oversight Committee has worked to develop a use of isolation community advisory group that will be having its first meeting in April of 2015. And we are asking advocates and content experts and stakeholders for their ongoing review and feedback of our policy and practice around isolation and on the work of the Oversight Committee itself. We have representation on that group from Youth Rights and Justice, Oregon Advocacy Commission, Disability Rights Oregon, Partnership for Safety and Justice, the Urban League, and Trillium Family Services. And so some of the outcomes that we're looking at as part of the Isolation and Reintegration Oversight Committee are how we can focus our limited resources to have the most effect on the use of isolation. This slide shows the percent of youth that account for the percent of isolation episodes. So we thought if we could identify who is using isolation most frequently and target those youth, that we could have an impact. And so you can see, for example, in 2014, that 20% of our youth accounted for 73% of the isolation episodes. So we've focused the efforts of our skill development coordinators on those 20% and are hoping to make a significant impact on that high needs group rate of incidents that lead to isolation. Another piece of data that we're looking at and focusing on is isolation duration, and as I talked about earlier, community reintegration. So this slide shows the breakdown of isolation duration during the month of February this year, and you can see that 68% of our youth are isolated for less than 24 hours. What we identified as a major service gap in the use of isolation is that community reintegration piece, but for both the youth who perpetuated the incident and for the youth and staff on the living unit. Many times after one of these incidents, we have a youth or a staff who has been assaulted by the youth that is in isolation, and or they have witnessed the assault and have some trauma around that. So we've really made it a priority to focus on how we can support restorative justice efforts and reintegration between those two parties so that we can welcome that youth back into the community and be ready to progress forward.
Can I ask a question on that one? What is the limit that you may use isolation now?
5 days consecutively.
So the one that says over 120 days, can you explain that one?
Yes.
120 hours?
Yes.
Which would be 5 days.
So there are some exceptions. In this month, we had 3 cases that went over the 120 days. Two of those were
120 hours.
120 hours, yeah. Thank you.
I did the same mistake.
Two of those were incidents that were so serious that the youth was not going to be able to return to the living unit and was going to move to a behavior management unit at McLaren, not the one that closed. And they were waiting for transport to McLaren, and their 5 days landed on a Sunday when we don't have enough resources to facilitate that transport. So they stayed one more day and were transported on Monday. And the third was actually a young man who requested to stay in isolation. He had been gang involved when he came in and had decided to remove himself from the gang lifestyle and was actually getting ready to be released, but had heard that there was a planned assault on him prior to his release, and he requested to stay in isolation for the last several days of his incarceration to try to avoid that situation, despite our efforts at assuring him that we would protect him in the general population.
Are we turning it to Clint?
We're turning it to Clint.
You want to introduce yourself?
Just a quick question on that. Been listening attentively to this, although it doesn't always look like we are here. Your assurances, these incidents unfortunately happen. What are those assurances that you can give to the general population that they don't have a threat of these abuses?
Well, I think that you're right, that we make our best efforts and that there is still always a possibility. I think that we try to do our best to be aware of tensions that arise between youth or groups of youth. We make a lot of effort to do conflict resolution and mediation between those groups so that they can come to an agreement. In fact, we're having a lot of success in managing our gang population by doing that conflict resolution at the outset. Again, this is something that is evolving in our system. So I think that there are youth who are still, especially youth who may have been in our system for years at a time, and the focus on mediation and kind of finding resolution is a bit new, that are still distrustful that can be something that works. So I think that what we try to do is assure them that staff are aware, that staff are positioning themselves so that they can be supervising that youth at all times and aware of what's happening. But there are still times when a youth can be vulnerable.
Chair Kenny Geyer and committee, my name is Clint McClellan. I'm the Assistant Director for Facility Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. I think another big piece to answer your question, Representative Hayden, we do have a real effort underway as far as changing the culture and really instilling the positive human development culture in our facilities. And a big part of that is developing relationships and engaging with youth. And we found the best security in any facility, in any living unit, is communication and trust and investment in each other's future. So that's kind of where we're headed, and we can only do so much as far as separating youth and segregating and isolation and the things that go along with what our staff or correctional practices say is safety. And we really need to shift, not give up those secure efforts, but also add in those relationships and the positive human development culture. That's what I'll speak on here quickly first, is our current efforts to change the culture. And we have started in February, this is 2 months now, a intake pilot program to really try on for size the new PhD culture. The purpose was really that for the intake pilot is to create a PhD environment in a close custody setting. And that's different. That's foreign to a lot of people that have worked in our system and around the nation. We've done this by doing a few things specifically. One is lowering the human density. Our intake units are very small units, and they had held up to 23 youth at a time. We dropped those numbers to 14 in February, and we made some modifications to the physical plants to make the just a better feel, more of a home setting versus a harsh institutional setting. And we changed the programming elements to really talk about how can we engage staff and youth and focus on skill development and not strictly compliance. Short-term outcomes, as you'll see here, have been positive. And I mean, these are short-term outcomes. We're talking not even 2 months into the program, and you can see the drop-off in those violent acts and acts that may produce isolation, result in isolation. We have dropped the numbers, so that affects it a little bit, but the proportion is real obvious and showing some good signs right now. The next thing I'd like to share is isolation at Oak Creek. Oak Creek is our young women's correctional facility in Albany, and they're the farthest along in really the PhD, employing the PhD concepts. They have a really good understanding of trauma-informed care, and in the past they've been given more resources targeted towards mental health and difficult case management. And they had a leadership change that had some impacts as well. So this is kind of a glimpse, hopefully, of the future when we implement PhD throughout all of our facilities. Challenges that Faribault was mentioning. I think a big piece is, Aaron alluded to it earlier, was the aging physical plants that was really, they were designed for best practice at the time, which is either you're on the living unit or you're in isolation if you don't manage yourself on the living unit. We also have a challenge with staffing patterns. We've staffed the living unit basically to make sure there's good supervision and can react appropriately to situations, but not necessarily do all the proactive work that is going to avoid isolation. And we're limited on the impact we can have after a youth goes to isolation. How do we reintegrate, and the energy and the focus we put on that young person to reintegrate back into the living unit? The culture is an obvious thing that I think I've been in the system working for Oregon Youth Authority for 26 years. And so I've been part of the culture, and the swing and the pendulum kind of goes back and forth. And I know how hard it is to do a wholesale change in culture. And so it's obviously going to be a challenge. But I think we have the right people in the right positions and have introduced positive human development in such a way that people are very interested and hopeful that it'll impact things positively. Opportunities. Mention the 10-year facility plan. I'm not sure how familiar you are with our proposal for to improve our facilities and to address the very issue that we mentioned before about our aging facilities. What the 10-year plan will do will expand spaces for us to do special programming. It'll bring down the human density to be able to split up our youth and lower that tension. The design that we're looking at is really to set up more of a college campus school feel versus a correctional institution that will automatically bring some tensions down. And so there's a lot of positive things that are in the 10-year plan. The full implementation of PhD is a great opportunity. We see some results already. And then the recommendations that come out of the Isolation Reintegration Oversight Committee are obviously going to have a direct impact on our isolation practices.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, just quickly in closing, I hope that we were able to communicate effectively the work that we are doing around the issue of isolation and how we are approaching it. I believe the agency has momentum. We are working well with the labor partners that we have, with advocates and stakeholders who are involved. Aaron mentioned some of those. I believe that the issue of isolation cannot be viewed in a silo. In fact, it has to be viewed as part of a bigger continuum. We have to be looking at the long-term treatment and reformation of youth, the safety of the facility, the safety of the community, and really the impact of isolation on other parts of the system. Thank you for having us here. I'll stop at that point and see if you have any questions or comments.
Questions?
Yeah, I just want to say I really do appreciate Representative Frederick bringing the issue before us and appreciate your discussion. I mean, it really is a critical element, I think, and a tool that we need to look at in terms of rehabilitation and so on. So thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And I just would like to echo what Rep. Gallego said in that. In addition, however, I've worked with the folks from OIA on and off for many, many years, and I do really appreciate the forward thinking and trying to find the best practices and then implement those best practices at kind of financially challenging times. So I was really impressed with the charts and the progress that's been made.
Thank you.
And we have a ways to go, don't we, on everything?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Representative Stark?
Thank you, Chair. More of a dissertation on this topic than it is a question. For the committee, wanted to make some clarifications and draw out some points that were in there, but I think are very important. So I'm quite familiar with this isolation concepts. I've worked at a residential treatment facility, and I was also the Tier 2 trainer for collaborative problem solvings, the module that they're talking about, so I want to talk about that. I did the OIS training, so I trained our staff on how to do the restraints, and I also audited all the restraints and isolations on a monthly basis, so I'm familiar with the processes that they go through. Some of the things that I've heard people say about isolation, so I probably should have gone around and sat there. One is, you know, in the past you would hear people talk about a trigger-happy guard that just is really upset at a child and therefore they're just throwing them in there. That's not possible. Okay, it's not possible because every isolation requires management approval. And not only that, you have somebody monitoring that child every 15 minutes. taking notes on how are they doing. Are they hurting themselves or others? You have your QMHP, which is your qualified mental health professional, who is evaluating them at least once a day. And then every time there is an isolation, there's the paperwork. I mean, the paperwork in of itself is a deterrent to doing isolation. And then you have someone like I would go through on a monthly basis to audit all of those, not just what child was in isolation, but also to what extent, you have to write everything leading up to and all the collaborative problem solving methods they attempted to use before resorting to isolation. So it is very, very difficult to have a trigger happy guard. When it comes to the idea of culture change, though, this is something I applaud your efforts to move toward collaborative problem solvings. I don't know if we'll ever hear from Kairos up here, but Kairos is kind of in the forefront in Oregon of formerly known as SOASTIC with their collaborative problem solving and what they're doing. And most, to my understanding, from some of the paperwork that I've received from you guys, the majority of their staff has been trained on collaborative problem solving. But that is a complete culture change, as they're talking about, and it takes time. 7 years ago, when I was at Kairos, the number of isolations and restraints, on average, we had about 3 per day, and sometimes more. There was a lot happening, and they were just integrating collaborative problem solving. Now, between that and facility modifications, mm-hmm. which is in part of their 10-year plan, they're down to about 1 a week. And so when I look at their records, when I look at what they're doing and the things that I'm actually very excited about the progress you're making. I do want to ask one of the things in the bill, and I don't know if this will be dealt with in the amendments. So I do have a question out of all that. It makes a reference to 60, no more, limited to 60 consecutive hours or less, or 60 hours in one calendar week. If a child has spent 2.5 days in a week in isolation and all of a sudden is having a major danger to self or others moment, if that were the case, that you could not isolate them, what other options would you have?
Can I handle it?
Sure.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. In that situation, our only option, if the youth was presenting an imminent risk to themselves or others and there was a limit on the amount of hours that he or she could be in isolation and he'd exceed or met that limit, our only option would be physical restraint, which is something that we try to avoid even more than isolation. And so it would be either physical restraint by our staff or use of a physical restraint device, neither of which is an option that we would be happy with.
And I ask that question because I've been in situations where isolation rooms were all full and there were children who were dangerous. And to sit there with two individuals restraining one individual, because you have to, it might be slightly different at OAA, restraining one individual mm-hmm. for hours sometimes, just provokes that individual more. And I've literally sat there, and people with other staff will come and put like a shield there because they're spitting in your face, and you have no other option. And I can't imagine getting to a point where you had no option. If someone did need that option again. So I'm concerned, I totally understand the heart behind that, but I'm very concerned about the idea of limiting those options, because sometimes it takes a season.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, thank you so much for bringing mm-hmm. that up. Our whole effort around this issue has been not to come down like a hammer on staff. And I can tell you, the state will remain nameless and the facility will remain nameless, but we just had a few staff who visited several other states as we go through this process of rebuilding our facilities to look at best practices. And one of these facilities that claimed not to use isolation at all was exactly doing that. Mm-hmm. They were putting a kid in a room. The room was not locked, so it was not technically isolation. But the moment that kid came out of the room, he got consequenced. And ultimately, they would use physical restraint and hold. So, I just want to convey to you, and I think you all know this, these problems are pretty complex. And as long as we are not looking at it as system-wide problems, we're simply squeezing the problem at this end, and it's going to pop up at some other end. Let me give you one brief example. And I actually have not done research to make sure that this is the case. But in 2009, we started using data and research to reduce the number of youth who we send to the Department of Corrections. As you know, we have the ability to send youth who are committed to us as adults as early as 16 years of age to the Department of Corrections because of misbehavior, et cetera, et cetera. In 2009, we actually sent 41 youth to the Department of Corrections for misbehavior. Because of use of data and research, we have reduced that number to 4 during the past 3 years, and in fact, last year it was only 1. Now, what happens when we do that? Now we're actually managing these problems in-house. So we are potentially isolating those youth, perhaps for longer intervals, but we're not sending them to adult corrections. So if you had a choice, which one would you take? I would not take either. I would not want to isolate the youth, and I would not want to send them to DOC. But if we have to deal with that kind of severe behavior, when you have youth who actually hurt severely, staff who, you know, go to the emergency room have, and have permanent damage physically, you know about that.
I've been put in the hospital.
Yes. So, you know, we are trying our best to manage this thing within our abilities and with the tools that are available without a mandate. We appreciate those who are concerned about the issue, but we want them to come to the table. I very much apologize for the tour that Representative Frederick took, which, you know, did not see the isolation room. I can tell you that a few weeks ago, we took a tour of legislators to McLaren, and they did see our isolation rooms. And I'm proud to say that if you would have come to that facility 3 years ago, and you would have had 30 kids in that isolation cell block, we only had 3. And this wasn't for show. This is real progress. But the moment that you bring down a hammer, you're going to, you know, make a staff very afraid, you know, for their safety, and we're going to have tension and problems. So to the extent possible, at the same time, I very much appreciate oversight and accountability. It's not about me. It's not. These are the best folks in the business, but we're not going to be here forever. We need to put a system in place that holds us accountable, so I understand that as well.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I really do appreciate this discussion, and I know that I recall, what is it, maybe 4 years ago, working with Shannon Wright, there was an effort to really look at what needs to happen within this youth corrections arena, and recognizing then that now we're talking about a culture change and so on. I guess my question is, and I know you're not speaking to the bill, but what would be your recommendation to the legislature? How can the legislature help, and what can we do?
Thank you, Representative Gallegos. My recommendation would be, before you pass anything, come and see what's going on. Yeah, you know, those people who want to pass a bill, we invite them to come and look at what the existing environment is. What are our goals? And then, you know, really, what does accountability look like? The issue is, are we making progress? Have us come back and report, you know, next year as far as what all this has resulted in. At the end of the day, if you're not going to isolate youth, you need more resources so that we can sit with youth, we can program with them, give us staff. Will reduce the number of isolation hours. So those are my recommendations.
I have a few questions.
Sure.
I'm going to build on the last one that you just talked about in terms of data. Mm-hmm. You had on slide 16, isolation at Oak Creek, where it went from about 850 up to 1,000 down. What are the units there? Is that incidents or is that hours?
That's actually on slide 16. That is the number of isolation incidents.
Okay. So you probably have this data somewhere. If you could send it to me, that would be great. I'd be really interested to see over time what the actual hours of isolation, so we can see, you know, hopefully that it's going down with some of these measures.
Sure.
I'm also curious if you collect data by race, age, other kind of, you know,
yes,
by facility. I'm assuming that you collect all
kinds of
data.
We collect all kinds of data.
Okay, great.
Yes.
'Cause that would be, I think that's really... And it's a big issue for this legislative session.
Yes.
Certainly looking at police accountability and others, where are there maybe biases that we're not always sure about until the data shows us mm-hmm. what they are.
Absolutely.
I wanted to also ask about, you mentioned several different rights that kids have. One is that they have a right to a hearing within 24 hours
right.
if they're held. Another is a 24-hour hotline. and another are the mental health medical visits. How are they informed of those rights?
We have a manager that directly works with the youth on a isolation or a review form, so they actually sign off. So they either accept the hearing or deny the hearing.
So every single time they're held over 24 hours, they have to actually sign off that they don't want a hearing or they get a hearing. And what are the results of the hearings in general? Is there anything that you can conclude? And who does the hearing?
Go ahead.
Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Kenny Geyer, excuse me, members of the committee. A manager does the hearing and explains to the youth the process and the purpose of the hearing. Most of the time, the hearing results in the youth, or the youth always has an opportunity to explain their side of the incident and to speak on their own behalf or to ask other staff to speak on their behalf if they feel like they are mitigating circumstances. And then the manager and the youth usually talk about what the expectations are for the youth to re-regulate and be able to move from isolation to the community reintegration phase.
So there's no kind of consequence. It's kind of talking through.
Exactly. Yes.
Representative Hayden?
Chair Kingegaard, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Really understand the concern. I may not understand all the process that you have shown there. But I really like the concept that you've been able to drive down the 41 that were previously sent to a correctional facility down to almost nothing. If one of these tools is taken away from you, or the amount of time or something is set in statute to 60 hours versus 120, we've heard the option of having to use restraints, which seems to be less attractive than isolation. I can understand that. But long term, it seems even more less attractive to have to have to kind of reuse that option of sending them to correctional facilities. So you, I don't know what resources they have available there, but my guess is it's much less. So would you, if we did put this into statute or put this into the regulations, do you see a possibility for that to be on the rise again?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, we will do our best not to send youth to Department of Corrections. Director Peters is my former director, great friend. It's not about DOC, it's not about their staff, it's about resources and funding. I can tell you that our own research, based on the number of kids who have been sent to Department of Correction, indicates that those youth who go to DOC for behavior from OYA recidivate at nearly twice as many percentage-wise as the youth who actually stay in OYA and finish their time with us. So we will not use this as an opportunity to send youth to DOC, but the reality is that if you don't have another option, and if the youth is continuously assaulting and not adhering to policies and principles, it will leave fewer options for us. It would be a pretty easy option to exercise, though we will do our best not to exercise that option because we know it's harmful to the future of youth.
Thank you.
Okay, one more question. Yeah, I want to make sure that we have the other time for the other people who have
Thank
signed
you.
Up.
I would be interested in seeing, as the chair was saying, some of the information, not just the demographics, but even if you can code. I'm looking at 13 people on one chart I have, or 13 incidents that were 4 days or longer. The one of the things I struggle with that when I read it, though, is that danger to self or others. If somebody is cognizant of enough to actually sit down and have a hearing, the odds of that they're still a danger to self or others. So I would be interested in on some of those longer ones, seeing kind of why they were there. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend everyone go visit one of these. I went and visited with one of my county recently, and I was actually quite impressed. And to hear the youth talk about the isolation, I had youth give me the tour, and they talked about the isolation room and the amount of time that they had spent there when they first got there versus now. It was very educational and very worth doing. So,
Chair Kenny Guy, Representative Stark, members of the committee, I appreciate your comment, and we do track the breakdown in number of hours, and I think that it speaks to some of that service gap that we identified about the community reintegration piece, and that often while a youth may not be an overtly imminent risk to self or others, the ability or the readiness of the community to reintegrate that youth and the re-regulation of the other youth and staff who witnessed or were affected by that behavior is not accounted for. And so we have a balancing act in how do we prepare the youth and prepare the unit. And we kind of have a physical plant that doesn't, and a staffing resource that doesn't promote our ability to do that as quickly or as effectively as we would like to at this point.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And now I'll call up Joe Ferguson, Bob Jundeff, and Salome Chimuku. Wants to start.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Joe Ferguson. I'm currently the Deputy Director with Jackson County Community Justice Juvenile Division, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Apartment Directors Association. We had submitted written testimony to you. I believe you have that in front of you. I just want to briefly go through this, and I will be responding to the bill, since it does currently in the language refer to juvenile detention facilities, which would be county operated facilities. Some of the current concerns we have is that the current law restricts the use of isolation to 6 hours. The bill increases that to 60. The Oregon Juvenile Department directors really look at limiting isolation and not expanding it further. I think it's really important to also share that there's a big difference between the Oregon Youth Authority youth correctional facilities and county juvenile detention facilities. A lot of the policies that OIA has is in administrative rule. County juvenile apartments are in state statute. And so the increasing it, you know, the use of isolation within juvenile detention facilities is very rare currently, and most facilities have more restrictions than 6 hours. Many have a 2-hour limit, so increasing that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us on those. And also in terms of the definition of isolation, statute has a much different definition than what the Oregon Youth Authority currently uses as well. Most of the county juvenile detention facilities all have single living rooms, not dorm living. So a lot of those are additional rooms in terms of an intake. They're designed just like a sleeping room. They have a toilet and sink. They have a bed. They have access to light and heating and cooling. And so really isolation is rare. It's more seclusion of removing a youth from a living unit where they may be disrupting the rest of the youth or are harming themselves or others or doing severe property damage. I think in terms of the bill would require a hearing that would include another youth. That's, you know, the issue with that is of why kids are placed in isolation could have a lot of of personal issues in terms of going on, mental health issues and such, and we don't feel it's appropriate for other youth to know that information. Under current law, in terms of the use of room lock, which can last up to 12 hours, there is a hearing process already designed in terms of staff that aren't involved in the incident of being the hearings person. And so I think that in terms of increasing the use of isolation is the wrong direction to go. We really like to see it of decreasing. I understand there's going to be some amendments to this bill, and it may not eventually have juvenile detention facilities in here, but as it's currently written, it does have a lot of concerns with the counties that, and there are 11 current juvenile detention facilities throughout the state too, so.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. Just a comment on the other youth in there. That appears to me to be a potential violation of our HIPAA regulations, so I'm not sure how you do that.
We prefer not to.
Other questions? I think that the bill was meant to be for OYA and not for the juvenile detention. But it sounds like one of the big differences is just the physical plant, you know, the dorm setting at OYA versus the, you know, the single rooms, which give people more of a peace of mind, probably reduce the stress and give people an opportunity to time out. Yeah. So that would be one. But the other is that your population is quite different. Is that right? The more serious cases would go to the state.
Correct.
And
juvenile detentions are much shorter term. Mm-hmm. They're averaging probably less than 2 weeks of being there. Some stay much longer, some less, but you know, they're not staying years.
Right. Thank you very much. Right.
Bob. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. And today I'm not really speaking directly to the terms of the bill, but just to provide some background from the advocacy point of view. I have, in addition to being at DRO, I've also served on the OIA Advisory Committee for about 15 years. Our organization is always particularly interested in restriction of people with disabilities in any setting, school settings, hospital settings, correctional settings. And so this is an area that we've concentrated on. In 2004, there was a tragic suicide in one of the isolation units at McLaren, and OIA contracted with a national expert, a man named Lindsay Hayes, to come in and work with what was called the Suicide Prevention Review Team to find out what happened and make recommendations as to how to respond. I was asked to sit on that team and did, and we really conducted a very, very thorough dive into the world of McLaren, and I learned an awful lot in that process. One of the things I learned is that at that point, and again, I'm talking about 2004, there really wasn't that much research out there about the effects of isolation on youth in correctional settings. Mr. Hayes had actually done some recent research about it, and so I learned about that. But just to share a few things that he said, I still have these documents. After all these years, he said that again, 2004, recently completed first national study on juvenile suicide and confinement identified 110 juvenile suicides in a variety of correction settings. And he said that half the victims who committed suicide were in room confinement status at the time of their death, and 62% of those victims had a history of room confinement. And that's defined as behavioral sanctions imposed on youth that restricted their movement for varying amounts of time, including isolation, segregation, timeout, and quiet rooms. And so what he did was that he drew a correlation between suicide and isolation. The Oregon Youth Authority has excellent data about the people who they serve, and the exact numbers, our friends can correct us, but about 70% of the youth that make it into a high custody status have a significant mental illness, and chemical dependency disorders. And so the group of people that they serve at that level is going to be particularly susceptible to mental health trauma. Many children coming in, youth coming in, who've had those experiences in their lives already. And so the completion of Dr. Hayes's report made a few recommendations. And again, things have changed quite a bit from that time, but one of the recommendations, is, interestingly enough, was to have staggered 15-minute interval personal checks on youth that were in isolation. At that time, there was a unit that you just referred to earlier called the Troy unit that has since been closed. But I remember when I first was introduced to that unit, I was actually shocked, and I've seen a lot of interesting things over the years in terms of facilities. This particular youth had actually succeeded in hanging himself from a wire grating that was available that he just looped a bedsheet through. So he had suggested that they make physical plant modifications as well, and recommended that there be formal assessments of suicide possibilities before youth were placed in those situations. What I came away from that experience was that what he said was that there's a strong correlation between room confinement and suicide. Since that time, I know I'm not an academic, but I know that there's been increasing evidence showing that isolation of youth have bad effects upon them, and you've heard about those from the experts earlier. And so as we approach a bill of this kind, I think it's important that that the issue be addressed. But I honestly feel that OAA has been making strides in terms of addressing it, and whether this bill is the correct way to go about achieving that, it's hard for me to say. But I think that they have made sincere efforts in moving in that direction, have had great success in moving in that direction, and I think we should commend them for that. I have additionally been invited to serve on their use of isolation community advisory group. I think that will be an important next step, because in all these environments, and again, not just corrections, but mental health environments and other disability environments, having staff who are well trained to recognize behavioral problems and not view behavioral problems as punishment-worthy episodes, but episodes that need to be anticipated, recognized, staffed, can really reduce injury to staff, injury to residents, and result in less trauma for everyone involved. Last thing I'll say is that we have been working on a bill on, it's on the Senate side, it's Senate Bill 739, that has to do with the same use of segregation and isolation of inmates with severe mental illnesses. And we think that the exact same evidence has been developing over recent years for that population. The Department of Corrections has the exact same challenge, which is physical plant problems. And so as we have learned, as our science has progressed in terms of isolation, we have, our physical plants have really not kept up. And this can really have tragic results for the people who are there. So that's what I have to tell you.
What was the name of the Senate bill? 739?
That's Senate Bill 739. It is set for hearing in House, in the Senate Human Services and Early Childhood Committee on April 7th.
Okay, thank you. Hello?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Salome Chimuku. I'm the public policy director at the Center for Intercultural Organizing. I apologize for my out of breathness. We have our profiling legislation up in a different committee at the same time, so I literally just ran down from there. So members of the committee, just to give you some background, this bill came up in essence to a big outcry from our members. There were definitely members that we had that had children that have been through this system, and particularly at OIA facilities. And one of the things that we try to do at CIO is listen to what our members are saying, compile what it is, figure out if there's a policy in place that is allowing this to happen, and what we can do about those. And so one thing I'd like to mention is that we've heard a lot today about the safety of the guards, but not so much the safety of the children. And I mean this not only in physical safety, but mental safety. We've had almost close to no reports come back that say isolation is good for the brain in terms of when in a mental health crisis or even just in general, and especially with juveniles. We also hear a lot that it's not usually used that excessive amount to five consecutive days, which for us is kind of like, okay, well, if you don't use it for five consecutive days, what is the pushback on limiting that time? Because for us, if there's a youth who's having a situation in which their behavior isn't deterred by five consecutive days of isolation, that means there needs to be greater intervention. And I did have an opportunity to chat, like in passing, with Joe O'Leary over at Oregon Youth Authority months way back, and express interest in working with them on this legislation. Haven't had the opportunity yet, but we definitely aren't looking to sort of hit OIA by any means on the head with this. It's more of a way to get them talking about this, because for us, just hearing this now about a 10-year strategic plan, that's 10 years. Like, most of the kids that are in this situation currently will no longer be at OIA by the time that that's done. And so what we're looking for is, how can we limit the use and duration? If that means that OIA needs more funding, great. Let's figure it out in terms of what sort of programs would you offer instead, and how can we best help to make sure that you could secure that funding? Because, I mean, if they came to me tomorrow with a budget that said this is our what we'd need to be able to limit it to this amount, I will be the first person testifying, say they need this money if it means that they are limiting the use of isolation for these youth and looking more into restorative justice for these kids. And one of the things that I'd like to say is that when we're dealing with these statistical numbers of it being on the decline for the youth, that's still lives that are detrimentally impacted by the use of isolation. Those are still consequences that that youth is going to face potentially for the rest of their life by being in isolation. And that's nothing to take lightly. Even if that number's on the decline, I want to see that number down to zero. And that's what we should strive for. And so as the Center for Intercultural Organizing is working on this issue, one thing that a lot of our members came about was just merely not knowing what exactly their child's rights were or the rights of the foster care youth that they had taken into their home. And in essence, when speaking to some of those youth who are currently serving right now, or the youth that have exited OIA, a lot of them, when asked, do you have this form that they're supposed to show you in terms of waiving your rights to a hearing or requesting a hearing, and asking any of them where that is on the page. And I didn't get a lot of answers back in terms of if any of them could tell me if it was on the front side or on the back side, or what that question looked like, which to me said that there needs to be a lot more work done on making sure that the youth understand what they're doing. Because outside of corrections, youth can't sign an agreement without the consent of an adult. And so I think that standard should be held, because when a youth is forced into OIA's guardianship or custodialship, as it were, OIA is their custodial guardian. And as a legal custodial guardian, we need to make sure that the youth understand what their rights are and what they're being asked to do, and make sure that they are aware of that and what they're signing away. And I think that we should make, we should try to strive in a way to make OIA act as a custodial guardian as opposed to a correctional facility. And I was speaking to a mother who is a member of our organization that does have a youth in corrections who recently was released about, I'd say, 8 months ago. And the mother had said that when the child had went to OIA, she was under the impression that OIA would be their parent in terms of that she could no longer be there every day to parent this child. OIA would help be that other parent, if you will. And what confused her was that OIA could do things to youth and children that parents could not do. And that's something that she did not expect in terms of child's rights and what can be done with children, and was very confused on how if she tried those own practices in her own home that her children would be removed from her home, but yet these children are being removed from OIA. And that was a sentiment that really stuck with us there at CIO, trying to figure out, well, what can we do to work with OIA to get them to that plan, but sooner, if that means that we need to help and sort of advocate for them to receive more funding so they can do alternative programming or getting more mental health crisis therapy, licensed therapists in there to address the issues that the youth are facing, then that is the direction we need to head, and not sort of a band-aid on the situation, which we feel is allowing this situation to happen until 10 years from now when we think we might have enough money or less children to be able to do that, but working towards what can we do now to push for that at a faster rate, because like I said, every hour in isolation is detrimental to a youth's mental health, and so we should be using that as little as possible and figuring out ways so that we don't have to use it, and intervention we feel is the best way to help that youth and promote a happy, healthy youth that will come out of OIA restored and rebuilt as opposed to damaged and recidivate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Starr?
Sorry.
That's all right.
Thank you, Chair. So let me, I do appreciate you guys shining the magnifying glass on this issue. I think it's an important topic that we probably should visit frequently and make sure that, because just looking at it makes helps encourage people to do better. So I do appreciate the conversation. I wanted to get your take on a couple of things that I asked previously or that I spouted off about. One of the things, with what would you suggest as an alternative if, you know, and I asked this question earlier, what do they do if a kid is at a 2.5-day cap or 60-hour cap in a week, as the bill is written, and, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, they're fine, and then Friday, all of a sudden, they have another incident where and they're legally now not allowed to put them in isolation, and this child is in danger to self or others. What would you recommend be done during at that point?
So that's a great question, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark. Although I am not a parent, I'll admit that, I would probably take a parental approach, which is clear we have a child who has done an incident. They were put in isolation. The max time was used because for whatever reason, they needed to do the max amount of time after the 15-minute checks that they're doing. I'm hoping that they do them, so I'm not going to use supposedly, but after the 15-minute checks and the time has expired, if another incident occurs, the first thing in my head is clearly that there's something deeper going on with this youth and that this youth is having an issue. And so at that point, my sort of take on the issue was that I would reach to the mental health professionals that work with this particular youth and sit them down and say, we need to figure out what's going on in this youth's life because they've had an incident twice in 1 week and we've reached the cap limit for isolation, which means that there's something a lot deeper than just this kid just hit another kid and that was simply it and it was unprovoked, or that there wasn't a sort of deeper issue going on with that child. Maybe that child just realized that they have a family member that just passed. Maybe that child has outside factors beyond the scope of just that 1 minute interaction they had with another youth or guard that's having an impact on how their behavior has impacted them. And I'd say this that in a sense, like, you know, I say this because when I was a teenager, which wasn't that long ago, I'll admit that, there are times that I have done things that I was necessarily not proud of. But there are times that I think that when an adult realized that what I was doing wasn't necessarily because I wanted to do it, but more so that it was trying to reach out for help or acting out about something that was happening at home or within another spectrum of my life, that that is what solved the issue. Because that's when you start to change a child's behavior, is when you find what is the root cause for this child to feel like their only option or means of option is to assault a guard or assault another youth.
May I follow?
Follow up?
I have like three questions.
Okay.
Fire.
Thank you. I appreciate, you know, that feedback. There's kind of two parts to what you just answered. One is the collaborative problem solving model is exactly what is it, that exact process, trying to dig deeper and figure out what is going on, what is triggering and avoiding future incidents. But as a parent of five, if my child runs into the road, I'm going to stop them. And if they try to run in the road again, I don't care how many times I've already stopped them, I'm going to keep stopping them. And that's one of the dangers of, yes, we hit a 2.5-day limit, and so they can't use isolation. But if that child is now a danger and is literally in danger of harming themselves, then we have to have some sort of a tool. And that's my biggest concern on this is if we remove a tool, what do we do?
Chair Kitty Guy, Representative Stark. My question, though, is in your analogy, have you stopped and talked to your child about not running in the road and figuring out why they're doing it in the first place? And I think that that is kind of what we need to strive for, is we shouldn't wait until our children are running into the road to talk to them about not running in the road. We should really figure out when a child is first coming in, what is going on with them in their life, and how do we make sure that they turn their life for the better? And that's what I said. If OIA came with an idea of a program they want to do and that they need more funding, I would be more than happy to testify on them getting that funding if it means that they are using isolation less. Because as studies have shown, as time goes on, the more you use isolation on the youth, the more actually detrimental and more hostile they become. And I am not going to kid you on this, is that you have a point in time where youth spend actual time reflecting upon why they're in isolation and what they did, and then there becomes a time and period in which they fester, which is after the reflection is done, they just more hyper-focus on who caused them to be there, and that hostility towards that individual or that system, if you will, becomes greater, and they become a greater threat to the individual that you tried to stop them from if the root issues aren't being addressed. And so that's kind of where we're coming from with the perspective of limiting this time and duration, because I mean, honestly, for me, 60 hours is a long time, especially consecutively, to be in isolation. And if for over 60 hours the youth is still exhibiting hostile, aggressive tones and threatening tones towards a guard or toward another child, I would then assume that this kid has something deeper going on that needs to be flushed out and spoken about.
One more follow-up, or would you like to defer?
I do have another part of the bill that I want to ask about.
Would you like to ask a quick question?
Real fast, I've sat here and listened to this, and I've been on Ed when we've talked about seclusion in schools, and particularly the form of seclusion that was really pretty shocking in our public school system, which does not actually mirror this as we are talking about youth. I'm curious, though, you know, the experience that you brought is anecdotally from a parent. Have you either A, toured the facility, or B, actually looked at those kids' files? And I say that because my sister was someone who was in and out of the juvenile justice system more than 30 times before she finally overdosed and died. And when I looked at her files after I did a public records request for them and read them compared to the stories, the anecdotes of here's what I experienced versus what I actually saw in the files, her anecdotal experience probably wasn't truthful. I'll just be very honest. And when I look at some of the things that I've saw, including as an adult, well, she was not a juvenile. I don't have her juvenile file, but looking at the adult file, but I know that she spent time in seclusion as a juvenile as well. But looking at that adult file and looking at the why she wound up in there, very different than the stories anecdotally I heard back from her. And so I appreciate this as a tool we want to reduce where we can. And I've also had other experience with siblings, children who've wound up in a isolation type of experience. So my anecdotal is then to go back and actually look at the data, because how they perceive what's happening to them versus what's actually happening sometimes doesn't align. So I'm just curious if you've had a chance to actually tour these facilities, but also, you know, as you're talking anecdotally with these parents, have you actually looked at the files, the case files of the child, and it's not just the parent secondhand telling you stories that came secondhand from their child?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish. Due to privacy and me not being related to the child, I can't look at their files firsthand. It would have to be a situation, so I'll leave it at that. I can't look at their files firsthand because I am not their custodial guardian, nor am I blood relative of theirs.
But parents haven't shared the files with you.
Parents have made requests of the files, have not obtained them yet. And so I am pretty sure when they obtain them, they'll ask me to take a look. But they have not received them yet, so I can't speak to the files that have come in. But what I will say is that in terms of the isolation, that tool perspective, I think that what's important or what was most alarming to me was not necessarily the instances why the parents that their youth was in isolation. In some of the cases, the parent was very admitting that their youth assaulted another youth or a guard of some sort. But more so that the youth didn't quite understand fully that they had a whole hearing process. And honestly telling these youth about it and saying, like, hey, you know that you can ask for a hearing about your situation. Have you explored that? A lot of them are like, sort of, not really. I'm like, do you know where it is on the page? As I had a form in my hand obtained from someone who worked at OIA. And very much so, I had one youth that took a stab at just guessing where they thought it was on the form, and they were wrong. And so for me, that kind of was what I personally found alarming, was the fact the youth didn't quite could even pinpoint where that hearing request was on there, and that some of them had the idea that by asking for a hearing that their stay in isolation may be longer because of the process in which it would take. And so I think that that was, for me, the focal point of, like, well, let's dig deeper into this and figure out what's going on. And I think that what I found also interesting is that the county facilities, local facilities, have in statute a limit at 6 hours. So hearing that made me wonder why exactly OIA has 5 consecutive days when our county juvenile facilities have 6 hours. And so trying to figure out, well, how can we get the OIA to that level of 6 hours to match the counties? And if that means that they need more funding, then again, definitely willing to talk about that and have that conversation. And
just my quick follow-up is, arguably the OIA populations are a really different subset of kids who are struggling rather than in a county. And I mean, I've got a nephew who's in the Polk County system right now. Very different terms than going into the OIA for those types of crimes and that type of activity. The level's different, certainly, between kids going into county justice versus going into state justice because of the level of criminality.
I just want to say we've got one minute. We're going to wrap it up here. You missed that part of the conversation. We did talk about that a little bit, so you can go back and listen to it in the recording.
Yeah.
But I'll just say thank you for bringing this. I think shining a spotlight on it is really important. One of the things that I hope to do when we start having fewer bills toward the end of the session is, if there's a chance to do a field trip, there's several that we could do. I think this would be a really interesting one, so we might try to organize that. And I'm being called to my office, so we have to go. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2706. Any announcements before we adjourn? Nope. Okay, we're going to adjourn the committee. Thank you.
Heading,
Commie Creek. Adjourn the committee. Thank you.